we'll get started. Can everyone hear me? All right. Okay. Welcome. My name is Nikhil Singh, and I'm the director of the Program in American Studies here in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. And we are just so delighted and honored to be able to host this event to celebrate the publication of The Next American Revolution, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century, authored by Grace Lee Boggs and Scott Kurashige. And we have events like this occasionally in our department, and while we think of this as a celebration, we also think of these as opportunities to have a fairly serious discussion of the works that we bring to the attention of our communities here. So the way we're gonna do the event tonight is I'm gonna talk for just about 15 minutes and introduce some aspects of Grace and Scott's book, and then Scott will speak as well for about 15 minutes, and then Grace will speak. And then there'll be an opportunity for all of you to ask Grace and Scott questions and have them respond. Okay, so we'll probably go for about 45 minutes and then open up for questions and comments. And then we'll leave some time at the end for books to be purchased and signed by Grace Lee Boggs, which is something not to be missed. So, and let me just also say as an announcement that this event is part of a two-day event that we're having here in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. Tomorrow, we have a one-day conference organized by the graduate students in the program in American Studies, inspired in part by Grace and Scott's book, Sustainable Activism for the 21st Century, and it will begin here tomorrow at 9 a.m. and go until 5 p.m. Okay, so I hope many of you can come back tomorrow and join us for all or part of the day. Grace Lee Boggs is an extraordinary intellectual and activist whose life's work spans more than half a century and engages the principal mass social movements of our age, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the peace movement, the women's movement, and movements for cultural and environmental justice. From her early collaborations with heterodox Marxist revolutionaries C.L.R. James and Raya Denisskaya, through her work with James Boggs and other key civil rights and Black Power activists in the 1960s and 1970s, through her contemporary engagement in activist struggles to reimagine and rebuild a blighted, deindustrialized Detroit, Grace Boggs possesses insights from historical experience that virtually no one can match. Yet even as her writing bears the weighty disappointments of the past, it also possesses the lightness and energy of someone who insists upon and exemplifies the maxim that without struggle, growth, and change, there is no progress. As much a work of historical reflection as a document of fierce contemporary urgency, The Next American Revolution is an inspiring testament to the wisdom of age and the ever-present possibility of renewal through human agency. Almost anything Grace Lee Boggs writes has an intrinsic interest. As an avid reader of the Boggs Center newsletter over many years, I eagerly await her latest commentary on the issues of the day. In the publication of her magnificent autobiography, Living for Change, in 1998, introduced a new generation of young activists and scholars to the full range and scope of her immense contributions over the past decades. This new work, written with Scott Kurashige, is a searching, original consideration of the problems of our time that, even as it offers telling reflections upon the course of Grace's life, remains firmly rooted in an activist present. Grace reflects upon at least four crucial political questions of historical consequence and contemporary relevance. And there's clearly more than four in this book, but these are just the four that I thought I might highlight for the purposes of this event today. Number one, how to rethink the meaning and logic of social movement in the context of the failure of communism and the waning of social democracy? 2, how to constitute a new relationship to questions of value, production, use, and exchange in this paradoxical age of material abundance, technological advance, social decay, and environmental disaster? 3, how to rescue the project of education from disaffection and disinvestment by empowering individuals and communities to engage in the here and now and to problem solve within the social worlds in which they are embedded. And 4, how to reimagine the work of social transformation and the work of work itself in a moment of extreme financial concentration and state failure, and to imagine it as an enhancement of capacities for self-knowledge and self-government by self-activated groups, communities, and localities across the nation and around the world. What makes these reflections extraordinary to me is that they are so deep and wide-ranging, and yet also almost entirely rooted in a long history of commitment to social change in one city. There's a great deal in this book that I did not know about Grace's important engagements with major Black revolutionary figures and intellectuals and activists across the decades, from C.L.R. James to Malcolm X, as well as her husband, James Boggs. For example, she offers profound reflections upon the political convergences between Malcolm X and Dr. King in the mid-1960s, honing in on what she regards as King's crucial insight, that durable social change in the United States would require a revolution in values that could contest the intertwined evils of racism, materialism, and militarism. The cornerstone of this revolution in values, Grace argues, is King's concept of agape, which she describes as the love that creates or restores sustaining forms of human affiliation, and which I might further define as the constituent power inherent in the very creation or formation of human community. Indeed, this is the deep conceptual logic of King's commitment to nonviolence that Grace suggests has never been fully operationalized as a form of politics. Yet lacking this concept, social movements, including those that followed in the wake of the 1960s, invariably foundered, failing to contest and at times reproducing the modes of manipulation, domination, sectarianism, and suffering they formed to oppose. Grace Lee Boggs loves Detroit. Indeed, this is the key to this book and what makes it such a moving work. The city is her muse. She is both its fierce partisan and its gentle healer. Throughout the book, Boggs describes Detroit as a kind of canary in the coal mine, a city and a people abandoned, traumatized, and made disposable by the epochal shifts away from industrialized economics and nationalized governing strategies. Detroit came early to these transformations, even as its mostly Black population arrived too late after the promises of the for whites only affluent society had started to evaporate for the great majority of African Americans, and now arguably for the great majority. The essays in this book are powerfully situated at the nexus of this great transformation and provide moving reflections upon its complexity. As Boggs notes, it was the Black freedom movement that offered the greatest insights into the limitations of social movements past, that viewed struggles for power and social change within a status conception as a zero-sum contest and divorced from questions of self-transformation. This movement in turn helped to seed much of what followed, a profound democratization of American life across age, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and ability, what Grace aptly calls, quote, the humanity-stretching movements of the past half century that still constellate the present horizons of democratic hope. At the same time, and as she argues, across the essays that comprise this book, the concept of revolution, if it's to matter and mean something, requires constant renovation. The Next American Revolution tells of Grace's work with and observations of young environmental, educational, and anti-violence activists seeking to rediscover and reanimate a lost movement ethos. From the founding of the Detroit Summer Collective to the Gardening Angels, who have reclaimed burned out city blocks for urban farming, Grace details a range of exciting civic experiments seeking to develop new critical connections of both ideas and people that can constitute alternative centers of social authority, learning, and nurture that are the essential ingredients to building a movement. These insights are neither naive nor cheaply earned. Drawing upon lessons of the past, Grace suggests that the current conjuncture calls upon us to wed systemic analysis of a society that puts profit before people to experimentation with and learning from localized, decentralized forms of actually existing agency and real utopian experiments to build and sustain community. To paraphrase another visionary Black intellectual activist, Ruth Gilmore, Grace calls upon us to prioritize making power over taking power, and to learn to value those singular efforts at social transformation, however small, that seek to illuminate the path ahead. Having said this, one of the questions I think her book does raise, one that came up in the interview that she did this morning on Democracy Now!, is what precisely is American about the next American Revolution? How do the politics of the local scale relate to large questions of capital accumulation and state power in an era that portends the imminent social death of the very concept of national society itself? The trajectory of the contemporary US offered to us by the right is that of a heavily militarized and intricately policed market state in an accelerated state of social decomposition where a semblance of consent is sought via the crumbs of residual national status, leavened with appeals to patriarchy, heteronormativity, and on the lowest frequencies, race. Despite its obvious failings, the Obama administration continues to fight a rearguard action against this situation, but one that seems to envision little more than a series of patches to what was already a deeply compromised and inadequate welfare state. Grace, I think, is asking us to consider a different and fundamentally more ambitious set of alternatives, ones based upon forging critical connections rather than building critical mass, and one that looks forward to new formations of social life and possibility in local spaces and abandoned places, rather than looking backwards to forms of mass politics oriented towards some pale recomposition of modern industrial society, the nation form, and the welfare state. This kind of thinking is obviously to be welcomed. The social democracy that much of the left often pines for as the horizon of the possible is not only backward-looking, but it was also never what it was cracked up to be. Race and gender segmentation, national privilege, consumerism, and ecological rapacity have in many respects been among its major bequests. As my colleague Lisa Dugan put it to me in a recent conversation, nostalgia for welfare state capitalism, which compared to neoliberalism can look pretty good, can't be what we want. At the same time, one of my questions to Grace is how do we overcome the fact that we do not have a meaningful and effective concept of the social formation outside the framework of the national social state? The rethinking of social and political scales is probably the most urgent political challenge of our time, to which her own work attests. But unfortunately, the ongoing replacement of the nation state by the market state not only hollows out the many democratic achievements of the past half century that were won under the egalitarian sign of nationness, but it leaves us still contending with the racist xenophobic husks of nationalism and with forms of anti-statist statism that purport to manage an era of increasing chaos with walls and cages. Indeed, nothing could be further from the urban garden that Grace wants to lead us to. So for me, this raises the still pressing question of coordination, scale, and once again, social movement with enough bandwidth, staying power, and socially reconstructive ambition to fulfill the visions that we have. Detroit may be a brilliant example of a politics of social reconstruction in one city, but I still think we need to ask, as King did, and as Grace has consistently throughout her marvelous life, where do we go from here? The next American Revolution, like its namesake and predecessor, James Boggs' American Revolution, implicitly suggests that a potentially excessive and disruptive democratic challenge remains a critical resource for contemporary social struggles at all scales. Against the depredations of the market state and the messianism of the military state that have effectively co-opted the term, democracy is still the best name for the aspirational politics of the governed, from Madison to London, from Cairo to Detroit. And as Grace might say, we are the ones we've been waiting for.
Well, thank you all for coming out today on this beautiful day. And thank you, Nikhil, for that wonderful introduction to the book. Hoping we can put it up on the website soon. And thanks for really helping to arrange this trip and to bring both of us out here. I really want to thank the whole Department of Social Cultural Analysis and Madala for helping with so many of the arrangements as well to make us comfortable. I want to thank Blue Stockings Books for coming and selling books. They'll also be doing an event with Grace and myself on Saturday evening at 7 p.m. I hope you guys can come and continue the conversation then. And to thank the graduate students for putting together this sounds like a really wonderful conference and to develop that theme, sustainable activism, to take it probably beyond where we've taken it in the book. And it's just really great to be here at NYU. I don't think I've ever given a talk here, so it's wonderful to see so many people, to be in a department with so many people who've influenced my work over the years. And I'm actually going to start by quoting one of your great former professors, Robin Kelly, who said at a recent event we did in Ann Arbor, he said, "If influence is measured by how much someone causes you to change your mind, then Grace Lee Boggs has been the most influential person in my life." And I think I would have to really echo Robin in saying that Grace, for obvious reasons, if you read the book, has caused me to change my mind on a number of occasions. And it's really interesting because I started off being interested in her and sort of attracted to her work because she represented so many things that sort of confirmed my own thinking. She was an Asian American. She was a radical. She is someone who had been deeply involved in the Black community, and people know any of my work. I've been very interested in Afro-Asian connections over the years. But then it turns out all the things that were most influential were actually things that caused me to rethink so many of my own assumptions. So I'm going to talk today about some of the ways in which Grace caused me to rethink my assumptions in hopes that maybe some of my own personal journey will have some resonance with some of you, particularly some of you that are still going to graduate school and sponsoring the conference. So just a quick survey. Did anybody watch or listen to Democracy Now! This morning? A few of you maybe? So Grace was on with Thomas Frank and Jim Wallace, and the topic was the state of the American economy, the state of America, in response, of course, to Obama's big speech on the budget yesterday. And, you know, to make a long story short, capitalism is a big problem. It's a bigger problem because now it's created a big mess for so many millions of people in our whole society. And if you didn't hear enough of that from Thomas Frank, Jim Wallace, you can go up the street and probably hear David Harvey lecture about that. So I'm not going to try to top those folks in lecturing about that. What I want to talk about is, so what do we do? Like Nikhil said, where do we go from here? And I'll say, again, a little bit about my own journey. So I started out as a rather reluctant academic. I had been radicalized as a college student. I was an activist. I was sort of doing a lot of work on campus while trying to stay in school and get just enough done so they wouldn't kick me out. And I was studying history And I was thinking of myself as a left historian, but I think at that time, before I met Grace, this would be in the 90s, I had a very narrow definition of what it meant to be a historian. I thought the task of a left historian was primarily to be an agitator, to expose the history of racism, white supremacy, of class exploitation, you know, sexism, patriarchy, and to give sort of people who are organizers and agitators that weapon, right? To show other students, to show other people, workers, people of color, women, all the ways in which society is corrupt and oppressive, and that therefore, you know, there are reasons why people needed to join political organizations and be involved in protests and social movements. And Grace really has helped me to recognize that we need to think about where we are on the clock of the world. She uses that phrase a lot. We need to think about where we are in terms of the evolution of humanity, in terms of the evolution of nations, of communities, of movements. And if we want to think about social change, we need to think not just about what's wrong with, you know, the people in power and what they're doing to the world. We need to think about, we need to think dialectically about our own identities, about our own movements, that we need to recognize that our own movements, even while they're opposing everything that's messed up in the world, need to be constantly thinking about our own strategies, learning from our lessons, learning from our mistakes, and learning how to resolve the internal contradictions that arise within our own movements and struggles and communities. And so I really think about history now as helping us to understand where we are in these turning points in history, and how history can help us think about the paradigm shifts that are underway in the world we live in. And so going beyond thinking about how bad the state of, you know, the economy and capitalism is, I try to do my own work now, both with Grace and with my own research, in terms of thinking about what it means to be writing and thinking about history and politics as we enter an age of the decline of the American empire, first. As we think about the decline of a white majority within America, and really globally as well, if we think about in terms of cultural and political influence, and to think, particularly coming from Detroit, but beyond Detroit, to think about the end of the industrial age or the industrial order, right? In terms of both technology, in terms of the social order that existed in the industrial age. And I don't mean to suggest that, you know, there won't be imperialist wars anymore, that there won't be racist attacks, that there won't still be factories where a lot of people work. But we think about being at a moment in which, again, there are paradigm shifts that are underway, and that we need to think about the evolution of history in terms of where we are with relation to these shifts. And at some point, I do believe, citing Emmanuel Wallerstein, that the whole global system is going to enter some kind of terminal crisis, and it may already be in a stage towards that. But again, the point is not to suggest that everything's going to collapse and that somehow, you know, some great party of the people will come and institute socialism or anarchism or something to take its place. And this is, again, what Grace is challenging us to do when she says we need to think dialectically. We need to think not just that we're ready to replace the people in power with something else because their system is in collapse. In fact, as Wallerstein says, the next system that comes could actually be worse than the one that we have now. So we need to be thinking very seriously about the new world that we're creating today, and we can't simply wait for some collapse to happen and some utopia to replace all the evil and bad stuff in the world. And this means we need to think about the idea of sustainable activism in a dual sense. The more obvious meaning that the way we're living now is not sustainable, and we need activism to promote more ecologically sound ways of living, more healthy forms of community. But we also need to think about activism as something that is sustainable, not as something designed to promote immediate gains, you know, or not just something to promote a protest or a big demonstration, but something that is a part of a revolutionary process, right? I spent a lot of times organizing amongst the sort of American left, and there was always this sense that we're preparing for that big moment, what Grace calls that D-Day moment, right? Where everything lines up, you know, the crisis amongst the internal conflicts among the bourgeoisie, the financial crisis, the inter-imperialist wars, and the people's movements, the working class, the oppressed nationalities will be ready to seize power at that moment if we have a disciplined party, and if we have the correct line, and if we have the right strategic alignment of the masses, whether they're the multinational working class or the oppressed nations or wherever the words. So leftists spend a lot of time agitating to get people to embrace those lines, and they spend a lot of time arguing with each other over those. And I think in a lot of ways, this is what I was doing for much of my 20s before I met Grace. And at first, I really didn't understand why she was struggling so much against the concept of the left, with a big L, and so much against old and outdated concepts of revolution that one time played a very significant role in history and must be appreciated, but can't serve us the way they served the Bolsheviks 100 years ago. Okay. So again, I think that's really an important point. And Grace uses the term two-sided revolution quite a bit, and she draws a lot from Martin Luther King to talk about revolution in terms of the means that we are using and not just the ends that we are seeking, in terms of an ongoing process tied to human evolution, not just evolution of biology, but evolution of our society and our humanity. And the last thing I want to say is that I've learned to appreciate the different vantage points from which we could view these struggles that are ongoing. So I grew up in LA, and I was studying Los Angeles, and I began to think about Detroit when I began to connect with Grace. And Detroit is obviously a very different city than New York or Los Angeles, because it's a city that's been losing population for a long time. It's a city that's been seeing capital flight rather than new investment. And in places like New York and LA, there's still a lot of wealth. There's still a lot of dynamism. There's still a lot of excitement. And a lot of people are drawn there. And there's also a lot of ways in which you're an activist, you can point to the inequality between the haves and the have-nots. Whereas in a place like Detroit, there's obviously a lot of inequality, but simply struggling for what's left of a decrepit auto industry doesn't make any sense. You know, fighting over the crumbs of a formerly bankrupt GM that's now been turned into some supposedly new model of a scaled-down corporation, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So what's happening in Detroit is people are forced, challenged, because the city really has been in this regime of budget deficits and austerity for a long, long time. This is not a new phenomenon in Detroit like it is in other places. So people have had to think about a whole new way of living, a whole new form of urbanism, and it's not going to sprout up overnight. So we have to draw our attention to what's happening at the grassroots level. The issue of race is something that Grace and Jimmy Boggs had to begin to look at very differently. Of course, they played a major role in anticipating and theorizing the rise of the Black Power movement. But then, as African-American politicians took power, and as the people who used to be community organizers became leaders of the school board and the police department and other commissions, they could no longer just talk about Black Power in terms of protesting an unjust white majority, in terms of replacing those in power, in terms of getting community control. People had to begin to talk about governing, and people had to talk about alternatives in a new way. And that was a huge challenge and crisis, given that blacks took power in Detroit just at the moment when Detroit's economy was collapsing. And so that's required a whole new way of thinking that goes beyond protest, beyond equating radicalism with militancy. And as Jimmy Boggs said, we could no longer think like a minority. We had to think as if we were the majority, not in terms of an oppressive majority, but one that's instituting a new system of governance and a new model of what a city could be. The last thing I'm just going to talk about is an example of some of this new form of activism emerging not only in Detroit, but particularly taking shape in Detroit because of this need to reconstitute community in places where entire neighborhoods have been abandoned. I mean, we're at the point now where they're talking about school sizes potentially going up to 60 students per class, where about 38% of the land and buildings in Detroit are vacant. And they're literally almost talking about shutting down neighborhoods, where services will be cut to a bare minimum, so people will have no choice but to move to other places if they want to have any kind of semblance of a normal life. And one of the things that's happened, of course, we've had terrible problems with police abuse and police brutality, but one of the core members of the Boggs Center is a former Black Panther named Ron Scott, who's really at the center of the Detroit Coalition Against Police Brutality. And what he realizes is that, although there's a lot of racist cops, although there's a lot of killer cops, that you simply could not keep protesting that forever and ever, even though they've had some great successes. That what they had to do was start creating forms of community organizing that would create what he calls, the coalition calls, peace zones for life. And the idea is not to let the prison industrial complex off the hook, but while we are struggling against this prison industrial complex, to begin creating a form of community relations that eliminates the need for families in the middle of domestic disputes to have to call the cops, which oftentimes is what leads to instances of police brutality or in many cases police killing. So again, these are different models of activism. They're not solely based on radicalism being defined by the old models of militancy and discipline. They're based more upon projecting a different form of relations. They're much more rooted in feminist models of leadership, shared grassroots leadership. And these are the ways, again, in which I think Grace's ideas are challenging us to think about radical politics in a whole new way. And I just want to close by saying, I used to always, I used to do a lot of organizing, and inevitably in the middle of something, someone would say, why do we focus so much on what we're against rather than what we're for? And I used to think, that's such a naive question. Don't you realize how messed up the system is? And until people realize how messed up it is and we get rid of it, we're never going to be able to have what we're for. But I've come to recognize, and a lot of this again comes from Grace as well as from Martin Luther King, that these principles of nonviolence, that these principles of love and hope are absolutely essential to creating any kind of sustainable movement. That when you organize on the basis of anger, resentment, and opposition, oftentimes that anger, resentment, and opposition turns inward, and you see groups fighting amongst each other and splitting and falling apart. And that what we need to do now is not simply, you know, chant slogans that demand access to jobs, healthcare, and education in this system, but we need to create forms of working, healing, and learning to transform the society that we want to start right now. And that we can't look for that vision solely from idealized utopian socialist societies like Cuba or Albania or China or Chiapas or Venezuela or anywhere else. That while we can learn and be inspired by those examples, we must have struggles that are rooted in our own histories and communities. And that we must project an alternative to the dehumanizing and unsustainable ways of the status quo. So that's what I've learned from Grace. That's what I have experienced in my new life in Detroit. And that's what I hope you will all take away from the book. Thank you very much.
Inviting us and making all the arrangements for us to come here, and Scott for having conceived the book, selected the contents, organizing, and making all the arrangements for the publishers. I mean, I could never have done it, but it's wonderful that he did, and I thank him so much. I thank you all for coming, and I particularly want to thank Roberta Luno, who introduced me when I made the speech, "These are the times to grow our souls," at the Convention for Animating Democracy in Flint, Michigan in 2003. After I spoke, we sat on the platform together and dialogued somewhat, and I thank you for coming. I think this was a really wonderful time to be alive. I hope all of you feel that. You know, I was a New Yorker once. I went to elementary school here. I lived in Jackson Heights, right near the Roosevelt Avenue station. I went to high school here. I graduated from college, from Bonner College, in 1935. And then between 1943 and 1953, I spent 10 years here in New York studying Marxism with C.L.R. James. And those were very important periods in my life. But the most important period began when I moved to Detroit in 1953. I moved to Detroit because, being a Marxist, I was looking for the working class to rise up and take over. And I arrived in Detroit just as the working class was shrinking. just as the automation, the high tech that had been developed during the war had been introduced into our plants. And instead of expanding, as Marx had pointed out in Capital, it was shrinking. And also what was happening was that the freeways were being built and it was enabling the white population basically to escape to the suburbs, leaving a predominantly black population. So the idea of black power arose out of the conditions of the city. We thought, why should whites be dominating the city council? Why should they be the majority on the school board? Why should the school superintendent be a white man when the students are predominantly black? It was a very simple, it wasn't a very angry concept of black power. It wasn't like the black power cry that emerged with Stokely Carmichael and Willie Hicks, Willie Hicks had a 1966 sunwash to Mississippi. It was a perfectly reasonable demand. If you're becoming the majority, you should have more representation in the government. But the response of people, of the white people, was so amazing. I mean, they thought we were a threat. And just the idea that blacks should talk in terms of power represented a threat to white people. And it's taken me a long time to get away from trying to threaten white people. Trying to develop strategies and slogans and language that threatens white people. Because revolution is not about threatening people. It's not about taking power from people. It's about what I discovered over this period. It's about expanding our humanity. And those of you, many of you here are too young to have participated in the movement of the 60s. But if you look at the movements of the 60s, they were not so much, they were about gender identities and racial identities and even age identities. But they were mostly about redefining human identity. We realized in the 60s with each movement that our country had been founded on the idea of economic growth. And in the pursuit of economic growth, we had dehumanized a lot of people, and that was part of our history, and that would have to be part of what a revolution was about. Instead, acknowledging, not so much what revolutions have been in other countries, acquiring more things, but recognizing that our acquisition of things over the centuries, over the decades, had been at the expense of other peoples, of other countries, and of the earth. And I think the insight into that idea that the revolution was about transformation, that a revolution was about changing ourselves, and not only changing our institutions, is so central to our thinking about the next revolution. And I think that's why, to my great surprise and happiness, this book has appeared to reach something in people. I think there's a sense in the American people at this moment that the empire is dying, and that defending the welfare state and the advantages and benefits that we have acquired as a result of being part of the empire is not what we need to do. That we're at a very different time in the history of humanity when we have to make a great leap in our humanity. That evolution is not only anatomical, evolution is not only physiological, evolution is psychological and spiritual. That I don't know what you folks think the soul is. Maybe you think it's a thing, I hope you don't. I think of the soul as the power within us to create the world anew. And I think this is a time to grow our souls, to embrace that power, to accept it, to exercise it. And you know, how many times in the history of the world has that happened? When I was a graduate student, my first year graduate student for our studies, I studied Hegel's phenomenology. I was 20 years old. It was a tremendous revelation to me. Hegel had been a young man dancing at the Tree of Liberty in 1789. He went through the trials and tribulations of the French Revolution. And after the revolution, he conceived an idea of dialectical progress. He says, progress does not take place in a straight line like a shot out of a pistol. It takes place through the labor, patience, and suffering of the negative. Just keep that in mind. And I think that learning that in my first year of graduate school was what has helped me over these years. To think, not to expect progress to take place overnight, not to expect it to race quickly, but to see adversity and negativity and patience and suffering as a challenge, as an opportunity to make a great leap forward. And that's what being in Detroit has helped me to do. I didn't understand that until I began to live in Detroit. I didn't understand that until the vacant lots began to appear. I didn't understand that until people began abandoning the city. I didn't understand that until the population dropped from 2 million, which was where it was when I arrived, to about, what it was about today, 800,000. And I was fortunate to marry Jimmy Boggs. Jimmy was born in a little town in Alabama called Marion Junction, a town in which there were more pigs than people. And he became a writer because when he was a child, most of the people in this community couldn't read and write. So he was the one who was a scribe for the community. And it was that which made him decide to become a writer. It was some example of how negativity is an opportunity to shape yourself, to create yourself anew. And I think that's how we have to think to understand history, and that's what helps us to act in particular ways. For example, in the 80s, as vacant lots began to appear all over the place, people looked at it as blight. Most people looked at it as blight. But there were elders who had been raised in the South who said, this is an opportunity to plant food for the community. And this is an opportunity also to help young people who are raised in the city, who think change takes place overnight and quickly like a push button, to begin thinking differently about change. So they were thinking about revolution, though they weren't calling it revolution, about a cultural change. And that's what's taking place now. And I think people recognize that that's what's changing now. Today, out of this effort by the elders, who call themselves the gardening angels, this effort by the elders to grow food has mushroomed into about 1,000 community gardens. People are growing their own food in Detroit. And in doing that, they are creating an alternative to agribusiness, which we all know is the source of much illness, as well as a lot of usage of fuel and and everything. I mean, that pollution, you know, the number of ills that it produces are too many even to name. But how did that emerge? It emerged out of looking at vacant lots differently. And that's what we're doing in Detroit. And that's why it has a kind of significance which probably might not have in other cities, because Detroit has been for almost a century, or was for almost a century, the national, the international symbol of the miracles of industrialization. And then it became the symbol, nationally and internationally, of the devastation of deindustrialization. And now it is emerging as the international and national symbol of hope for a post-industrial society. And that, you know, to be part of that is a blessing. And so people come from all over the world to write stories about Detroit, to make documentaries about Detroit, to interview us, and to get a sense that we have not reached the end of the world just because industry is kaput. That there is something that comes after industry, and that in fact the commodification of all our relationships, the commodification of earth into land, the commodification of work into labor, that all that which took place a few hundred years ago is now on the threshold of being overturned. And we are part of this overturning. And we didn't choose to be that. But we were human beings, not in government, but at the neighborhood level, confronted with these realities, embraced the power that we all have within us to create the world anew. And so we are doing what we're doing in Detroit, you wouldn't believe. We're not only planting what we call freedom gardens, because we believe that until you can feed yourself, you can't free yourself. Until you can take care of your own basic needs, you're not free. We're bringing the neighbor back into the hood. Instead of depending upon the police, upon the authorities to maintain order and peace, we are beginning to look out for each other. Instead of thinking of the schools only as places where kids go to be trained to become part of the industrial machine, we're beginning to see kids as part of the solution rather than as the problem. To see that if we enlist them into solving the problems of the community problems get solved, and we don't have that terrible gulf between the generations which has emerged in the last few decades. I don't know how many people realize how devastating that is, how humanity has not evolved because of gulf between generations. It has evolved because the generations have been close to one another. So we're on the threshold of this re-emergence, this next stage in the evolution of humanity. And we're all lucky to be part of that. And I don't know how you can feel that in Detroit, in New York, but I know that because you can feel it in Detroit, and because we've been fortunate enough to write this book based on our experiences in Detroit, that we are at a time on the clock of the world where the opportunity we all have has been enlarged and enriched by its being stated in the book. So I hope all of you will feel that you buy the book and that you share it with your friends. I'm amazed at how it has the responses received. I understand, I don't know how it happened, but Amazon apparently writes with bestsellers by Noam Chomsky and Paul Krugman. I don't know how they choose that. But I'm glad they're stuck. What I find is that people not only buy the book for themselves, but they buy it for their family and their friends. That there's something in it that speaks to the hunger that exists in the human heart at this time. And we all need to have that enrichment, that expansion of ourselves. I hope you all ask questions and I can answer them, but I want to know where you are.
Field of questions for Grace and Scott.
Questions? I'll repeat them to you.
Don't be shy. Yes.
I was wondering how your ideas of working with the land, how much of that is influenced by Native culture?
How much of it is
influenced by Native culture? Because on the left, there's generally not that much of an awareness. Like in the U.S. anyways, Canada's a little bit different, but like Native American culture.
Did you hear it first?
I'm not sure.
The question is, how much have your ideas about land been shaped by Native American culture?
I'll hold it.
All right. My ideas are shaped a lot more by my reading. I have to confess that I'm a terrible reader. I'm a great reader, actually. But a book that I recommend to everybody is The Great Transformation by Carl Polanyi. How many people know that book? It's a wonderful book, The Great Transformation. Carl Polanyi was a Hungarian economist. And he pointed out that until a few hundred years ago, people related to the earth as earth. And the idea that there's land and there's property is a very recent development. And we think it's always been that way. And we are lucky that there are Native Americans who remind us that the earth is much more than land. But personally, while I am close to a certain group of people on a pueblo in New Mexico, my ideas have come more from books, I have to confess.
Come on now. This is your opportunity, yes.
I want to share.
Could you speak up, please?
First, thank you very, very much for sharing your ideas and your beliefs with us. I want you to comment on a letter that I recently got, actually a form letter, that Pete Seeger sent to many, many of his friends. And in it he said, the agricultural revolution took thousands of years. The industrial revolution took centuries. And we're at the dawn of the information communication revolution. And where it will take us, we don't know yet. But what he said for himself, he finds it very important to talk to people who don't believe as he does. Would you comment on that?
Well, I don't know where the information revolution is going to take us either. But I do know that we have not paid sufficient attention to how 11,000 years ago we went from hunting and gathering to agriculture, and a few hundred years ago from agriculture to industry, and how many of our concepts changed in the course of that transition. So I think it helps us to look at those points of transition and understand cultural revolution and the ramifications of cultural revolution and what that embodies. We have thought so much of revolution either mostly in terms of political revolution, because our ideas have been shaped so much by the revolution of 1917. But we are lucky that we have lived through the 20th century, that we have experienced how capturing the state makes you a prisoner of the state. That's a lobby to have lived through that. When I joined the movement back in the 40s, we were still arguing about whether the Soviet Union was a worker state or a degenerated worker state. Our ideas of revolution were so tied up with nationalization of property. And we were still within the categories of property. And I remember this because I was talking earlier to somebody about this. I don't know how many of you think about the African revolutions, but I happen to have been quite close friends with many of the leaders of African independence from the 60s. And it wasn't until quite late that I recognized how much those leaders had been male, how many of them had been educated in the West, how many thought of liberation in terms of taking hold of the government, as Nkrumah said, give us the political freedom and everything will be granted unto us, and how little they understood agriculture and the role of women. And it wasn't really until Wangari Maathai initiated the Green Belt Movement that people began to understand the role of women. The men who ran the country and sought independence weren't thinking about how the women fetched the water and the wood, and how therefore they were concerned with the earth and with what was available on the earth. And to this day, people are not clear about that. And I think the U.S. Social Forum was just held in Dakar. And I don't know to what extent they understood that. I'd really like folks to think about that and read Wangari Maathai's latest book called Replenishing the Earth.
Can you just talk about what you've learned about speaking out in public over the years and how you've thought about what you're going to say when you're in front of audiences?
I'm not sure how to answer that question. But a few years ago, a woman who studies rhetoric visited me and she said, "When did your rhetoric change?" And I hadn't thought about how my rhetoric changed until she asked me that question. And then I realized that while Jimmy was alive, he died in 1993, he was such a forceful speaker, and he was black, and there was a period of black struggle, that I had actually left most of the speaking to him. The only time I spoke up was when I looked at women in the audience, and I thought, if I don't speak up, I'll be spoiling them to make their lives real miserable. And then when Jimmy died, I was on my own. And I wrote to a publisher asking her if she would publish a book on Jimmy. And she said, "I'm interested in a book on you." And I never knew that I had anything to say. And then when I began to write my autobiography, I discovered that I had nothing to say, and that changed my rhetoric. And then it began to emerge. Sometimes I write out my speeches, sometimes I don't.
Thank you so much for coming. I was wondering if you could reflect on some of the collaborations and relationships you've had with youth and younger generations over the years, and how that has changed or influenced you.
The question is, can you reflect on your collaborations with youth and how those collaborations have influenced or changed you?
Well, a turning point in the history of Detroit in my life was 1992. What had happened in the 1980s was that a lot of youth violence had erupted in the city, and unemployment was getting worse. And we did a number of things to try and respond to it. We marched on crack houses, We formed a group called We the People Reclaim Our Streets. We first. We created an organization called SOSAD, Save Our Sons and Daughters. But then Coleman Young, who was the black mayor, had been elected in 1973, not only because we wanted a black mayor, but because in the wake of the urban rebellion, the white power structure decided that a white mayor would no longer be able to maintain law and order, so we got a black mayor. And he didn't know what to do about the vanishing auto industry. So he proposed a casino industry. He said casinos would bring the jobs that the auto industry was taking away. And we decided to oppose them. And Jimmy wrote an article called Rebuilding Detroit, an Alternative to Casino Gambling. You can find it on the Bob Center website, www.bobcenter.org. And we said, why don't we ask the young people to rebuild, redefine, and re-spirit the city? And so we called together a group of young people. We called the Detroit Summer, sort of imitating the Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964. And not a great many youth came out, but the 30 or 40 young people who did come out planted community gardens, reconnected with the earth, reconnected with the elders, painted public murals, rehabbed houses, created bike alley workshops for transportation for young people, and created poetry workshops to rethink our language, to rethink our thoughts, actually, not just our language. And we found that young people are a wasted resource in our society. And I think that if we take that experience seriously, we will understand how much we have deprived our young people of the opportunity to be of use, which is what every human being needs. I don't know whether you know a poem by Marge Frissy called To Be of Use. The last two lines go, the pitcher, P-I-T-C-H-E-R, yearns for water to carry, the person for work who is real. And young people yearn for work that's real.
I want to just add a note on that. I mean, one of the most popular progressive slogans, and Grace talks about this a lot, is money for schools, not for prisons. And we know there's this huge bloated prison industrial complex. It costs more money, you know, to send a kid to prison than to educate them. And that's an important struggle going on. And it's part of what's happening in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio and other places. But in Detroit, partly because the scale of the problem is at such a higher level, right? The unemployment rate for young black men is probably over 50%. The dropout rate is 50% or higher. And the schools are literally in what looks like a potential terminal crisis for the Detroit public school system. 75% decline in school enrollment over the last 10 years and projected to go down more. And of course, that's left a huge budget deficit that's leading to basically another takeover by the state where they bring in these emergency managers who then get to run everything according to their, you know, unelected mandates. So it's partly because of the scale, but also because what Grace talks about, and there's a clear chapter on education that deals with this, is the need not just for more funding for the school system and not just for more public schools instead of money for vouchers or, you know, charter schools, but a whole different type of education that's about creating new citizens for a society that is beyond empire, that is beyond industry, and that is beyond this notion of a white majority that we're aspiring to, you know, become equal with or integrate into, right? And that, I'll just save the rest for you to read, you know, to get a sense of the examples of why the models coming out of Detroit are very, very different. Partly because we have no chance of winning those struggles over funding, even compared to Wisconsin, because our economy is in such terrible shape and the marginalization of inner city Detroiters is in such terrible shape. But because the imagination, the creativity is so, so important at this critical juncture in history.
Thank you.
See, I think to understand that, I really urge you to read chapter 5 in the book. It's called A Paradigm Shift in the Concept of Education. Because I think paradigm shift is what we need to be doing. I mean, and to take a situation which is in such critical condition as the schools and education, and to understand paradigm shift in terms of schools will help us understand paradigm shift in work and in other things as well.
Okay, so there are a lot of hands, and we have time. Okay, so Andrew?
I guess my question is about the institutional left. We've never had a left-wing political party in this country, and some people lament that fact and complain about it all the time. And other people say, well, the absence of an institutional left representation, that level of government, has been the source of the energy of so much of the activism that has poured into civil society movements, social movements for the last 100 years or so. So, and on balance, which side do you come down on? And if you don't believe in the position that talks about the energy that's flowed into movements, what kind of institutional left would, in your mind, be a preferable one or a favorable one?
Well, I think the important thing is to look at this question historically. When in the left organizations of which I was a part, we used to argue, should we be for a labor party or should not be a labor party? We split into groups around that question. The labor parties emerged in Europe mainly because the people had to fight not only against capitalism, but against a form of feudalism. And we lacked feudalism in that sense in the country. So we didn't form a labor party here. And I think the kind of struggle we did over that question and the amount of verbiage we wasted on each other was part of a period that's passed. For us who have lived through this period, we have seen how civil rights legislation, how the Voting Rights Bill, Civil Rights Bill were both only passed in the wake of the movement on the streets. The battle was first won on the streets, and then we had the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Bill. So, I mean, we have the experience as well. We don't have to argue about the question as a theoretical question, but I think it's helpful to understand it historically and why we don't have a labor party in the United States.
I want to quickly address that because, you know, we're seeing the collapse of whatever's left of the welfare state. And on the one hand, you've got, because you don't have a Labor Party taking up that mantle, you've got the Tea Party on the right, essentially my left, but you're right, which of course wants to blame everything on immigrants and people of color and lazy union workers and liberals and whatever else, right? And then you've got, of course, these movements, places like Wisconsin, that have to sort of embolden the Democratic Party to take any kind of stand beyond its kind of sort of wobbly centrism. And so the people are calling for bigger and bigger demonstrations. And so we have that kind of left-right split going on. And I think, you know, obviously it's an important struggle. It's one we should pay attention to. But really what you tend to hear from the left, both from the liberals and sort of the more radicals, is that there needs to be more bigger demonstrations. That the Democrats, Obama, the Congress, they need to have more of a spine, fight back more against the Republicans. And that may all definitely be true, and I'm certainly sympathetic with teachers and firefighters and other people that are struggling for collective bargaining rights. But what Grace is talking about, right, is again recognizing that these are 20th century struggles, and even though they were never finished in the 20th century, we have a whole new set of struggles in the 21st century that we need to be working on and organizing right now, right? So how, and this is a big challenge, we don't try to answer this in the book, this is for all of us to answer. How do we take the energy and the anger and the resentment and the creativity in some places emerging out of these struggles between the Tea Party and Scott Walker and Madison, Wisconsin, and places like Detroit, how does that all translate into something new? I don't think it's gonna happen by everyone joining one organization or one party, right? I don't think that's what you're suggesting. But somehow we need to have a theory and a vision of social change that involves, you know, Hart and Negri talk about the multitude, and there's a lot of affinity with their work and Grace's work. But these are sort of not fully theorized, and Wallerstein talks about needing to have a certain appreciation for uncertainty, and we're going to have to struggle and figure a lot of this out. But we need to have a certain set of values and humility that goes into this. I think that's important.
We also need to think beyond numbers. One of the things that I really urge brown people is reading Margaret Wheatley's book, Leadership and Modern Science. In this, she points out how if you think in Newtonian terms, you're always trying to increase the numbers. But if you understand quantum physics, you understand that the connections are what are critical. And even something that takes place on a small scale, if it's organic, has meaning.
Okay, I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative. I'm gonna take three questions now, okay? Or three comments, and then give you guys a chance to respond. And then we'll probably get to do one more round, you know, before we have to break. And we'll go as long as you have energy to be here. I think Grace's energy is quite inexhaustible. Yes, please.
All this talk about uncertainty and creativity makes me want to ask you about what kinds of new relationships you might imagine between activists and artists that are differently oriented than artists being the kind of tools to forward a message or to decorate the rallies or etc. I ask this because in 2005 I was at the World Social Forum in Brazil, and I went to a workshop about organizing forums, and there were people sharing best practices, and there were about 40 or 45 different forums being spoken of. And I asked the room if there had been artists on any of the organizing committees, and not one in the world, not one anywhere in the world had they been asked to be part of the thinking of organizing these. Everyone said, oh yes, we had so much art, we had gallery exhibitions, etc. So this to say, in Detroit, I wonder if any different kind of relational understanding between artists and activists is beginning to develop.
Thank you so much for being here. It's really a pleasure to get to hear you talk. I guess learning a little bit about you and your participation in Black civil rights and feminism and class struggle and environmentalism very heavily, I guess I wanted to know, I'm sure that you've been through many a tense meeting and uncomfortable situation. So I'm really interested to know what's allowed you to sustain yourself as a multi-issue activist. What's been something that has allowed you to make those critical connections in the midst of what at times are kind of, you know, struggles that are contentious or can be not aligned with one another?
I had two questions, and Melanie asked my first one, actually. So I would like to look at the amount of philanthropic focus that Detroit has had, you know, especially as kind of an American symbol, and also as this post-industrial city that kind of is a harbinger of other cities. And so my question is really about the role of philanthropy and the kind of caveats that you would have for, you know, what type of approaches or interventions may not be appropriate, or on the other side, what would you advise would be the role positively that philanthropy could have?
Did you hear all the questions, Grace?
I'm not sure about some of them.
Okay, so the questions are the role of art and artists in movement building and activism, what sustains you for so many years of your work in so many different movements, and what role, how do we think about the role that philanthropists, foundations are playing in Detroit and remaking Detroit today?
It's so interesting, that last question, the first question about uncertainty. Wallerstein has written a book called The End of the World, and we know it, we went. And then he says, the uncertainty is the basis of hope. You know, when you're young, which I once was, you think that certainty is the basis of hope, and you grab onto something that is systematic and sort of enables you to believe that it's necessary that something take place. But as I've grown older, I think I've learned that not knowing what's going to happen has been what has sustained me. That people are surprising me all the time. The things that people do, the way, you know, a few years ago, a group of National Black Farmers came to Detroit, and they said, we can't free ourselves until we feed ourselves. So I wrote that on my bathroom wall. And some people came to the house and decided they would create a Feed 'em Freedom garden. People surprised me all the time because there's such creativity in folks and they respond to reality if we just keep our eyes open and if we see not only with our eyes but with our hearts. It's amazing what that does. If you connect with people and people connect with you and they know that you're viewing reality not only with your eyes or with your mind but with your heart. I think that's what sustained me over the years. The question I find asked over and over again is the question that Robert asked about being funded. I have a lot of hesitations about funding. I think that one of the things that was very helpful in the generation which came out of college in the 80s and 90s was that they wanted so much to do organizing in the community. There was such a sense that community organizing was really what mattered, that they took jobs from nonprofit corporations and didn't think it through enough. I'm very wary of accepting funding because I have found that it creates a gulf between volunteers and paid organizers. And how we deal with that requires a whole lot of careful thought. Kim Shirobi has some very good ideas about that.
I'm gonna answer real quickly too to supplement what Grace said because she left out a couple things. I mean, one of the things that's so important about Grace is her concept of dialectics means that we need a constantly changing and evolving analysis of the constantly changing and evolving reality, right? So, and I say this again as someone who spent a lot of time on the left, I have a lot of friends on the left, but as someone who recognizes, like what Grace says, we can only make leaps forward in our understanding if we think about our own internal contradictions, crises, and limitations. So there are a lot of people on the left who have basically a fixed view of what capitalism and imperialism and racism are, and they have a fixed view of what socialism or the alternative it is, and they just get more and more depressed that things are getting worse and worse and getting farther and farther away from that utopia, right? And people on the left can burn out very, very quickly because of that. And I think one of the things that keeps Grace going is she's constantly embracing these new contradictions and crises as a new challenge to understand the world anew and to recognize that there are new sources of inspiration and change and creativity that are redefining radical change. We're not there yet, but we may never get to an end point in any event, I think. And the artists are really important in Detroit because they're seeing this crisis as an opportunity to bring forward creativity and imagination. And so the artists in many ways are inseparable from the activists at this point. On the other hand, the philanthropists and the urban planners are also looking at Detroit as this blank slate where they could just come in because there's such a big budget crisis that the mayor will take any source of funding and allow people to try out whatever experiment they have that's going to sort of make their portfolio as, you know, in this RoboCop fashion, if you guys have seen, you know, the RoboCop series. So that's the contradiction there.
How many people heard of the Allied Media Conference? The Allied Media Conference is a conference of young people, led by young people, many of whom came out of Detroit, some of who have managed to deal with this question of funding and creativity, I think in a very creative and new way, they have their own ideas, which they begin projecting, and they solicit from other young people, and then they get funding. They don't allow the funders to shape what they do.
And just the last point on artists, we need to really thank Danny Glover for writing a very moving forward. Danny's been having some incredible conversations with Grace, and a lot of these are on YouTube, so check those out too.
So we'll take one more round of questions and comments, and then I think we'll break, and there'll be opportunities to talk with Grace a little bit more informally and to have her sign your book, which is available in the front. Andy, back?
Thanks to both of you for coming and visiting us. There's been a lot of attention on Detroit lately, and Grace speaks a lot about Detroit as a place of hope and a kind of bastion of hope right now. So I'm curious, in light of the comments that Scott just made about the dangers of Detroit being seen as kind of a tabula rasa that anyone can come in and experiment with, I'm wondering if either of you or the great the Boggs Center are encouraging people who share your values to come to Detroit and repopulate Detroit and work with you, or if the idea is more that people should kind of be trying to move towards these new visions of humanity where they're at, or if there's any worries about a flood of people coming in and perhaps overwhelming the voices of the people who are already there doing the work.
I have a question about your background as a Marxist. I'm interested for people who study Marxism and are interested in class consciousness, the difficulty is getting communities, society to wake up to the conditions of the class struggle. You talk about revolution in a different way than I've heard before. Often it's around agitation, creating anger, for directing that anger towards a hope for change. And you seem to just exude this joy around the revolution. And I wonder if that ties into a vision for waking people up to the reality of where we are in capitalist society and what that does for the potential for revolution.
I just wanted to know if you could talk a little bit more about the paradigm shift that in relation to education. I'm a teacher ed program right now, and I want to know what I can do as a teacher to help move that along. I'm very concerned with the way the public education system, what's going on in the system right now in New York City, and I just wanted to hear like more of your thoughts on how we as teachers can help.
Okay, so the first question is, a lot of people are coming to Detroit, and how do you feel about, should we be encouraging more people to come do this work with us in Detroit, or should people be trying to do models of that work where they currently are? The second question was about, oftentimes, we want to develop, if we have a Marxist analysis of society, that we want to develop a class consciousness, but sometimes, she was saying people have a hard time responding to calls to sort of stir up their anger and resentment, and you seem to be promoting a sense of joy and wonder that goes with revolution. And the last question was about education. Could you say more about what a paradigm shift in education means, particularly for teachers today trying to, you know, struggle to work with youth in the schools?
Well, on the first question of people coming to Detroit, they're coming. Because there's a lot of housing that's cheap. I mean, coming to Detroit is very different from coming to New York. I mean, even though you have public transportation in New York, rents are high, food is high. In Detroit, we have plenty of space. The houses are big. You can rent a house or buy a house for practically nothing. And so there's a certain amount of tension that's developing between the people who are native to Detroit and have stayed there for a long time and the young people who are coming in who are primarily white. But I don't, that's going to be clever somehow. I don't know how, but it'll take care of itself. And I don't, what I do won't matter. There's already a movement underway to remove these rights. On the question of Marx, one of the most important things I did when I joined the radical movement was read and translate the early philosophical essays of Marx, the economic philosophical essays of Marx from 1843 to 1844, which were written when he was a very young man. He was born in 1819. And I think there are passages in Marx that I love and that are in my mind all the time. In the philosophical essays, he talks about species essence. He had a concept of humanity, and it comes from his Hegelian background. And in the Manifesto, which was written when he was also still a very young man, he was not yet 30, he has a paragraph which I read along, write, and quote all the time. It goes, "Constant revolutions in technology distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all preceding epochs." And it ends with a statement, "All that is solid melts into air, all that is sacred is profaned, and man is at last compelled to face with sober senses his conditions of life and his relations with his kind." That was written in 1848. This is now 2011. And it's true. It's true. The time has come. I think that the movement in education is one that's going to be probably the most exciting during this next period. And I envision teachers entering into it, though at this moment they're on the defensive. I spoke at a National Education Research Association convention in Denver last year. And I felt a restlessness among the teachers that they were ready for something new. The special summer issue of Monthly Review will be edited by Bill Ayers and his brother Rick Ayers, and it will have a number of issues on education, including one by me.
It's up to you. Okay, well, that's still so many questions. We'll take one more round, okay? but that's it, and then... we'll go over here first. And then I'll come around that way.
In terms of the quote you just gave from Marx, the economic manuscripts, sacred becomes profane, you know, things reverse. I'm thinking a lot about the industrialization of what we used to think of as agricultural or rural America, with the hydrofracking pressure for gas drilling going on in New York State and in Pennsylvania, for example. And this odd situation where, on the one hand, the country is about to be industrialized with massive amounts of drilling and trucks and pollution, and perhaps the loss of its abilities sustain agriculture. That's already happened in parts of Pennsylvania where farms have shut down because the water has become polluted. And yet in Detroit, a city, an urban scape, there's this desire for agriculture. And so I'm just kind of wondering about who does the land belong to? That question, whether it's in, you know, we don't seem to be able to stop the gas companies from doing some of these things because the land is privatized. It belongs to private individuals in the rural areas. And in the cities, is there, for example, a homesteading kind of act going on that would perhaps give hope to migrating people or to the masses of immigrants who need housing? I mean, you mentioned white people moving in, but are there immigrant groups moving in to kind of become homesteaders the way we once had homesteaders in rural America? Is there some to whom does the land belong in the cities once it's kind of cheap and abandoned? Is it still private property?
What does it look and feel like when people make organic connections? And is it something that has to start with an individual, or can they find something and then become connected to it?
There's a guy that just left. He wanted to ask you about Mexicans in California, Mexican American California, but he left. But now, I got a couple of things. One is that, in terms of education, the living community here or the demographics of New York, there's a whole lot of African Americans. If you look around the room or if you look at NYU, you'll notice that there are no programs for poor people, and there are very few representations of the majority or a large majority of people who live in New York City here. But I'm sure the same thing is true in Detroit, Wayne State, University of Michigan, et cetera, et cetera. This is education. It's not little kids in school, but it's real education. It's preparing people for their life's path. And of course, this is a community here, Lower East Side, that was comprised of poor people for a long time, a lot of artists who are now being moved out because of gentrification, because of this school's building a lot of dormitories, taking over a lot of property that they own, just like Columbia University owns a lot of Harlem. So that's the whole question. I don't know how you would want to address that. My other question is this. North Africa, the Middle East, I would like to hear what you have to think about that, because it seems to me between Libya and Egypt, Yemen, you name it, the Ivory Coast, there's a whole other thing going on that I don't see the left really responding to in any way that makes any sense to me. So those are my questions.
Okay, so the first question, it's kind of a complex one. I'm not sure if we can really answer. I mean, there's a lot in the book. We take it more as a comment. There's been a lot of foreclosures. There's a lot of bank-owned properties. There's a lot of land that's in dispute. Even the city doesn't have clear title to it. So it's really what happens when all these lawyers and corporations can just take so much control over the land that it really just ties communities up in knots. And so there really needs to be more of a struggle over some sense of the commons being reclaimed and land trust and so on. There's people struggling around that, but it's not at a very developed stage yet. And so what may happen, again, are these massive just rezonings of huge areas where the city comes in. But it's all really being fought over right now. The second question was, how do we recognize when people make organic connections? What does it feel like? How do you know the difference between that and, you know, other attempts? And the last question was dealing with the fact that there are still large black urban populations that feel very marginalized and excluded from the urban institutions that come in when the gentrification takes over. And he also asked, how do we think about what's going on in Egypt, Libya, North Africa, these struggles, revolts, and put those into some kind of context with your thinking?
Well, on the first question, I would say if you substitute the word earth for land, you'll answer your own question. The second question.
Organic connections. What does it feel like to make organic connections?
Well, I'm going to talk about inorganic connections. One of the most important discoveries or thoughts that was developed in the last period was the book written by Basil Davidson, who was a really wonderful writer about Africa. He had gone to Africa during World War II and had fought in Africa, and he fell in love with Africa and wrote something like 19 books in Africa, on Africa. His last book was called Black Man's Burden. And then he wrote about how the burden of the African leaders and of the African states was that they had tried to create liberation within the boundaries established by the colonialists. Those are inorganic connections. Organic connections, talk to Kim about those, about how she went back to her neighborhood where she grew up and where she began reconnecting with her family. and understanding that building community began rebuilding her family. On the, let's see, what was the exception?
On what's happening to urban black populations, is it gentrification, and people being, having their...
If you go through a Vox channel YouTube, you'll hear some remarks that were made by my husband, Jimmy Vox, in his last speech to a group of University of Michigan students. And he said, you have to stop thinking like a minority, because when you think like a minority, you think like an underling. And I think that's what we should say to black populations. That's what I say to black populations. Maybe you don't feel free to say that. But I think to continue looking at blacks as victims and to encourage them to think as victims is very doing them a disservice. The world today is a world that is still, as I'm not saying that it's a post-racial world, but it's a world in which thinking racially is very debilitating. And whether you're white or black, that's true.
Egypt, North Africa.
North Africa. I follow that struggle. It's interesting. But I don't think it's the main struggle. I think the main struggle in Africa is to look back at the historical development of the liberation struggle and understand what were the contradictions that emerged down there and to try and overcome them. And you're not satisfied?
No. That's okay.
Neither am I.
Okay, well, let's please give a big hand to Grace.